Okay, good morning. Today I'm going to give a short introduction to spontaneous symmetry breaking and the Goldstone theorem. And if I have time, I'll also start talking about non-abelian gauge theories. I'm not going to go into too much detail on either one of these at this point, and because I want to move next week immediately into quantum chromodynamics. Before I begin, I want to make a correction. I answered a question incorrectly yesterday, and I don't know what I was thinking. The question was whether a Lagrangian had to be invariant under space reflection or under parity, and of course the answer is no. It's a purely physical question whether a given Lagrangian has a certain symmetry, and experimentally the strong interactions are invariant under space reflection, as are the electromagnetic, but weak interactions are not. So, okay, let me talk about, I've been talking now for a couple days about global symmetries. A symmetry in general can be, whether it's continuous or discrete, global or gauge, can have come in a number of different guises of how perfect a symmetry it is. One can have an exact symmetry, which actually has two implications. One is the one that I've been emphasizing, that the generator of the symmetry commutes with the Lagrangian. This is for a Lie group symmetry, but it's the same idea even with a discrete symmetry. If the Lagrangian is left invariant, that's one condition. However, there's another condition that I did not emphasize, but which I was implicitly assuming in the example so far, namely, the second condition for an exact symmetry is that the ground state of this theory, the vacuum state, is left invariant under the symmetry. And in the case of a Lie group, that means that the generators acting on the ground state give zero, so that e to the minus I theta dot t acting on the ground state just gives you back the ground state. So these are the two conditions for an exact symmetry. Now, so this refers really to the equations of motion. And this refers to the vacuum state. Now, many symmetries in nature, in fact, most symmetries of nature are not exact. A symmetry may be broken. And there's two ways in which a symmetry can be broken. The most familiar one is probably explicit breaking, in which one writes that the Lagrangian is equal to the sum of two pieces, and the one piece commutes with the generators, and the second piece breaks the symmetry explicitly by not commuting with the generator. And again, I'm writing it in the case of a Lie group and with generators, et cetera, but the same ideas apply to any type of symmetry, space-time symmetries, discrete symmetries, et cetera. And if the L1 is in some sense small, then it makes sense to say that the first approximation, you've got the symmetry, and then you can calculate perturbatively the corrections. And in practice, it's especially useful if the L1 has some definite transformation property under the symmetry, such as breaking a rotational symmetry by having a vector, a magnetic field pointing in the z direction, and that transforms like a vector. And then you can make useful calculations. However, there is a second type of symmetry breaking that is possible. Namely, one can violate the second condition. And this is known as spontaneous breaking. Namely, the generator acting on the ground state might be non-zero, so that e to the minus I beta dot t acting on the ground state gives you a different ground state, or gives you a different state. It's not left invariant. And perhaps the most familiar example of this is this a ferromagnet. The equations of motion of a ferromagnet, a bunch of electrons with their spins coupled, the equations of motion are completely rotationally invariant. And a ferromagnetic domain could have all the spins aligned this way, or all the spins aligned that way, or that way, or that way, completely rotationally invariant. But if you take a real ferromagnet or a real domain of one, they have to line somewhere. So the ground state actually is breaking the symmetry in the sense that it's lined up however it's lined up. Another example of that, which will be mimicking a lot in the field theory, is the wine bottle potential, or Mexican hat. And for the moment, I'm just talking about a classical potential. Imagine, I'm not very good at drawing this, but imagine you've got the bottom of the inside of a wine barrel, of a wine bottle. So, you know, the bottom of the wine bottle has a little indentation that points up, and then there's a sort of a circular line at the bottom that's actually the lowest energy state. So if you took a little marble and put it in this wine bottle, the symmetric state, well, the potential is rotationally invariant under axial rotations around this axis. It's completely invariant. And one solution to the equations of motion is the unstable one, in which the particle sits up at the top. That's consistent with the rotational symmetry of the potential, but that's, of course, unstable. And if you put a real marble in a real wine bottle, it would actually fall down and bounce around for a while, but eventually come to rest at some point. And it could come to rest at any point along the bottom, but it comes to rest somewhere. And this is simply a statement that the lowest energy state is necessarily, the lowest energy state is not rotationally invariant. So that's spontaneous symmetry breaking. You can combine the two and have both spontaneous and explicit breaking present at the same time, such as, for example, by slightly tilting the wine barrel or bottle. And if you tilted it this way a little bit, then there would be a definite unique lowest energy state. Now, the spontaneous breaking is going to have a lot of consequences. And the first consequence, as we'll see, is that first of all, the symmetry is somewhat hidden. If you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, even if the equations of motion are completely invariant, the solutions will not manifest that symmetry. It's there in some hidden way. Secondly, in the case of a continuous global symmetry, the type we've been talking about, there will be necessarily a Goldstone boson, which is a massless spin zero particle. And I will illustrate that with an example. In the case of a gauge theory, this massless Goldstone boson disappears from the spectrum, but reemerges by making a gauge boson massive. But that's the Higgs mechanism, which I'm not going to talk about until we get actually to the weak interactions. Okay, so now, suppose we have an exact symmetry, that is, that the exact symmetry of the Lagrangian, so that there's the equations of motion are symmetric, then one has what is called the Goldstone alternative. And it's a matter of semantics. People sometimes say, in this case, you have a symmetry, but it can be realized in two ways. One way is just Ti0 equals 0, and this is called the Wigner-Weil realization of the symmetry, the exact symmetry. And consequence for a continuous symmetry is that particles fall into degenerate multiplets with relations between their couplings. And the other alternative is this one, the spontaneous breaking, and this is the Goldstone realization, or sometimes the Nambu-Goldstone realization. And here, the symmetry is not manifest. You have, for example, the Goldstone bosons. Okay, now to illustrate this, although this theorem, as I've stated it, applies to a continuous symmetry, the basic idea of spontaneous breaking is true for any symmetry, even a discrete symmetry. And so I'm going to first illustrate it there. There's no Goldstone boson for a discrete symmetry, but nevertheless, one can illustrate. So I'm going to consider a single Hermitian scalar field. Spin-zero field, phi, which is the same as its adjoint. And the renormalizable Lagrangian that I can write for this is 1/2 b mu phi squared. And we lump all the non-derivative terms into something that we call the potential. And the potential is just some polynomial. And the 1/2 and 1/4 are just convenience factors if one does perturbation theory. And this is the most general renormalizable case. A phi to the fifth or a non-polynomial would make it non-renormalizable. Now, this has no internal symmetries in general. However, one can impose. So it's like any physics problem, I can decide what problem I'm going to consider. So I'm going to impose a symmetry, a so-called Z2 symmetry, which is a discrete symmetry. Z2 is simply the two-element group consisting of plus 1 and minus 1 with ordinary multiplication. So in other words, under this Z2 symmetry, I'm going to choose the representation that phi goes to minus phi and insist that this be a symmetry. I'm going to consider the problem that is symmetric under this. And that immediately requires that A and sigma vanish. And V of phi, therefore, takes the familiar term of a mass term and an interaction term. The Euler-Lagrange equations of motion for this Lagrangian are that d squared dt squared minus Laplace acting on phi is equal to minus dv d phi is equal to minus mu squared plus lambda phi squared phi. Now, usually in elementary field theory, one says, well, phi is, you have quantization conditions, and phi, the free field solution is something involving creation and annihilation operators, it's a pure operator, et cetera. But when one writes that, one has implicitly assumed that the ground state of the theory was completely empty space, that there was no classical background field. But more generally, in a relativistic quantum field theory, one should think of the equations as first having a ground state solution, which is really the classical solution to the theory for a classical field, and that the lowest energy classical solution might be just phi equals zero, and then you quantize around it. And the thing you quantize around it is the thing with the A's and the A daggers. However, the lowest energy classical solution might actually turn out to be not just zero, it might be something non-trivial. This is very much like in quantum mechanics. If you have a quantum mechanical potential problem, and if you've got some potential in which the minimum of the potential is at x equals zero, you quantize around this and say if it's a harmonic oscillator, that's what you do. However, if you've got some classical potential that's more complicated, you would find the lowest energy classical solution and you do your quantization around that. All right, so let's solve this as a classical field equation, field theory, and find the lowest energy solution. Well, first of all, I'm not going to go through the apparatus. If you write, I will denote, first of all, the classical solution this way or this way. And if you construct a Hamiltonian, and I'm not going to write down the Hamiltonian of this, but it's given in any field theory book. If you construct a Hamiltonian, you will immediately find that the classical solution is one in which d by dt of phi equals d by dxi of phi equals zero. In other words, phi is a space-time constant, because it turns out any derivatives, either space or time derivatives, increase the energy of the solution. So therefore, our classical solution, this term vanishes, and all one needs is that dv d phi is zero. I'm not going to keep writing. In principle, what I really mean is when evaluated at the classical solution, but I'll not usually bother to write that part. Well, dv d phi, v of phi is just given by this, and v of phi was this part, and it's a quadratic plus a quartic term. Well, there's two possibilities. One is that mu squared is positive, and lambda is positive, in which case the v of phi looks like just like this. It's harmonic oscillator down here with the quartic terms up here. And clearly, the minimum of, or the solution to d phi d zero for mu squared positive is that phi equals zero. Classical solution is zero. And in that case, you proceed to quantize, and it's just a very normal thing. I didn't draw it very well. I should try to make it look a little more symmetric. Now, I'm only going to consider lambda positive. If lambda were negative, if mu squared were positive and lambda were negative, then the potential would look like this. For sufficiently large phi, the quartic term would dominate. It always and the eventually the potential would go to minus infinity. In that case, this is, although this would be okay classically, you should intuit that it's an unstable situation, and indeed that would be the case. If the lambda were negative, then the vacuum would eventually decay. So we're not going to consider that case. So this is mu squared positive. You can also put in a small breaking if you, well, let me defer that statement for a moment. So that's the mu squared positive. Now one can also, however, consider the case that mu squared is negative and lambda positive. Now, if you haven't seen this sort of thing before, people often have a reaction, well, how can mu squared be negative? Mu squared is a mass squared. Well, the point is it's not a mass squared. Mu squared is simply a parameter in this expansion of a potential around zero. And if mu squared turns out to be positive, yes, indeed, it will be a mass squared. But if it turns out to be negative, it's not really the mass of any particle. It's merely a parameter in your potential. So if mu squared is negative, the potential looks like this. And the second derivative is negative at the origin. It's not a stable point. For sufficiently large phi, this is V of phi, the quartic term eventually takes over to stabilize the potential. But clearly, the minimum is here or here. There are two minima at this potential. And so phi equals zero is unstable. It is an extremum of the potential, but it's not stable. And the minima are at plus or minus nu. Phi equals either plus or minus nu, where nu is equal to square root of mu squared, of minus mu squared over lambda. So there are two minima, and this is familiar in any even classical situation. There are two minima. You have to pick one and just consider that as the state you're starting with. So that's, without loss of generality, it's just they're equivalents. So let's just choose phi equals plus nu. So this is where we're going to quantize around. And then I can define the original field to be nu, the classical value, plus some nu phi prime after I just shift. So I'm going to phi prime is just a field after I subtract this classical value. And this is the normal classical field, the thing obtained that has the A's and A daggers in it. I can rewrite the Lagrangian in terms of the new variable. Then, so L phi is equal to, I substitute nu plus phi prime, and I'll just substitute this into the original Lagrangian, this one. And I find that I get normal kinetic energy term for phi prime. And then I get some new V of phi prime. It's really V prime of phi prime, if you will. And V I usually just write it V of phi prime, but it means after. It's just the expansion of V written in terms of nu and phi prime. So I get, first of all, a constant term. Let me write the whole thing, and then I'll talk about the terms. The constant term is simply the fact is simply this. The fact that V is negative at the minimum. This is the least important term of all, and it's also the most important term of all. In classical and quantum physics, you can add a constant to the potential, and it has no effect on equations of motion. It has no effect whatsoever on physics. So it's totally irrelevant. However, the second that you try to couple this to general relativity, the constant acts like a cosmological constant, and it can be devastating. This is probably the biggest problem in theoretical physics, the fact that spontaneous symmetry breaking generates cosmological constants that are typically enormously larger than the observational one. And I'll simply leave it at that for now. It's the biggest problem in the Standard Model. It's the biggest problem in any other grand unified theory, string theory, or anything else. Why is the cosmological constant so small experimentally? In some sense, it's not a real problem because I could have just added a constant, a primordial cosmological constant, if you like. I could have just added a constant to the original potential and chosen that constant to be plus mu 4 over 4 lambda, so that at the minimum it's really zero. But that's fine-tuned. I mean, it's picking this constant to exactly that's there to begin with the thing from the symmetry breaking. It seems very artificial. You can do it, but people don't like that. Okay. This is the m phi prime squared over 2, or mu phi prime squared. That is the sign here is negative. Mu squared is negative, so this is positive. So the mass squared for the phi prime is this minus 2 mu squared, greater than 0. This is just a quartic self-interaction, which is just a remnant. This doesn't care at all about the spontaneous breaking. It's the thing that was there to begin with. But this is the induced cubic. This is a cubic interaction between three phi primes. And that wasn't there. There was no cubic interaction here because I had imposed this discrete Z2 symmetry to get rid of it. But it reemerges when I do the spontaneous breaking. And of course, this is just a remnant. You can think of this as the four-point interaction, but allowing one of the four legs to just disappear into the vacuum. I've replaced one of the four legs by its vacuum expectation value or classical value. So my Z2 symmetry is not manifest in the equations of motion. It's lost. It's there at some level, but you don't really see it directly. It's hidden. Are there any questions? Yes. Yes. No, because as I said, in this theory, if you state that there was none to begin with, and that this is it, it's the only source, then this is the definite prediction at tree level. There will be, when you include loops and go to the effective potential, it will be modified by loop effects. But I mean, in some sense, yes. But the real problem in physics is, suppose you have some underlying, say, grand unified theory. That generates a cosmological constant that's 120 orders of magnitude larger than what's observed, and of the wrong sign. Then the electroweak breaking generates another contribution that's 54 orders of magnitude larger than what's observed, and of the wrong sign. QCD by itself generates another contribution that's, 40 orders of magnitude big and of the wrong sign. So you have to add all those up and say there's some other mechanism we don't know that compensates all of them. So. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. What I'm saying is anti-de-Sitter is fine, but what's out there in the universe is de-Sitter, not anti-de-Sitter. Okay, now just a last comment on this is that in either case, you can add an explicit breaking. Explicit. So one could have, for example, V of phi equals mu squared phi squared over 2 plus lambda phi 4 over 4 plus the term linear in phi. This explicitly breaks the Z2 symmetry, but if A is very small, one can think of it perturbatively. What that would do to the potential is simply tilt it a little bit. So if mu squared is positive, then in the presence of that term, you would get just a slightly shifted potential. And in the case of mu squared negative, you would get a potential that's a little bit asymmetric here. And in that case, well, in the first case, mu squared positive, one can easily minimize the potential, and one finds that phi is equal to A over mu squared. And in the case mu squared less than zero, one finds that phi is equal to the thing I had before. And then it's shifted a little bit by plus A over 2 nu squared, where this is nu. I've just repeated it there. So, and that's only the first order in A. There's higher order correction. So you can add an explicit breaking as well. And if you have an explicit breaking, you always induce some vacuum expectation value, which is small in this case. That's known as Coleman's theorem, actually. Explicit induces spontaneous. If you started out with spontaneous, in this case, it doesn't have a big effect, but you do somewhat, you remove the degeneracy. Yeah. Oh, there is no Feynman rule because this is at the level of the classical potential. And the Feynman rule is only something that comes about after you have quantized and rewritten everything in terms of phi prime. There is no linear term because, think about it, what we've done is always we choose dv by d phi at the minimum is zero. That determines the vacuum expectation value, and then we quantize around that. So when you quantize around a minimum, there's obviously not going to be a linear term. If you do have a linear term in a potential, it means you picked the wrong vacuum. You have to do a shift of the fields. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah. I'm sorry, if I were to start from what?
If we say we start from this theory and we do spontaneous breaking,
yeah.
Once we start the question, won't we be forced to introduce a linear term to drive won't that term be generated?
Yes. And in fact, I only worked at lowest order here. And so in principle, one needs to calculate loop corrections to the potential. You get something called the effective potential, and you actually have to minimize that effective potential, which means it's the thing that includes the loop corrections that won't have the linear term. So if you calculate it here, so in other words, it's a perturbative thing. The loop corrections will induce always a small shift in the vacuum so that the overall linear term vanishes.
In that case, will we lose that?
Yeah, you're losing the, well, you're losing the, oh, I haven't thought through exactly how the Z2 works in that case, but it is the case that you do always have to calculate order by order in perturbation theory, everything gets shifted a little bit. I'll say in words that there are other classical solutions that are not necessarily constant. And those go by the names of domain walls or cosmic strings or magnetic monopoles, which are also classical solutions, but which are not the lowest energy one. That takes me too far afield to go into that. But by classical solution, you can think of, well, think of any classical Coulomb field. That's a classical solution to Maxwell's equations. And a classical bosonic field can be thought of as just a Bose condensation of photons or whatever. So here I've only considered the lowest classical solution. What would happen if you had not never heard about any of this and just tried to quantize in the original basis with the phis, if you really did it consistently, you would find that you had an instability and that there would be a Bose condensation into a state that corresponded to what I called the vacuum expectation value. Okay, any other questions? Okay, let me now promote this to a complex scalar field. And I'm going to take L to be d mu phi dagger d mu phi minus V of phi, where V of phi is mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And I will pick lambda positive for the same reason as before, otherwise I wouldn't have a stable vacuum. As an aside, well, I'll make the statement later. This has a U1 symmetry, namely phi goes to e to the I beta phi dagger goes to phi dagger e to the minus I beta. And there's a conserved charge associated with it. You could call the phi the positive, annihilates a positive charge if you like, and phi dagger is associated with the negative charge. So this is a continuous symmetry. And the statement I wanted to make is, this is not the most, you don't have to have a conserved charge. You could perfectly well have a renormalizable potential that had something like a term like phi dagger phi times phi plus phi dagger, for example. That's a cubic term, or phi squared plus phi dagger squared. Your Lagrangian has to be Hermitian, but you can have more general Lagrangians in this one. These would not have a U1 symmetry. They would not have a conserved charge. That's just an aside. It's not something I'm going to be worrying about using right at the moment. Now, it is sometimes, it's often convenient for to go to a different basis. This is the complex basis, but you can also go to a Hermitian basis. A complex field is equivalent to two real fields. Namely, I can write phi was phi 1 plus I phi 2 over root 2, where phi 1 and phi 2 are permission. Sometimes in some contexts, I'll define the field with a minus sign here. It's purely a matter of convention. And it's perhaps more intuitive to write plus I and phi dagger is minus I. But it's purely a matter of convention where you put the, as long as the sign is opposite. In this basis, L becomes half d mu phi 1 squared plus d mu phi 2 squared. You notice there's the extra half for Hermitian kinetic energy terms, minus v of phi 1 phi 2. And V is mu squared over 2 phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus lambda over 4 phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared all squared. In this basis, it is obvious that the symmetry manifests itself as an O2 symmetry, as a rotational symmetry in two dimensions, under which, in this basis, the actual transformation is that phi 1, phi 2 go to cosine beta, minus sine beta, cos beta, phi 1, phi 2. And clearly, this Lagrangian is invariant under this continuous rotational symmetry. And this is just an example of why the U1 and SO2 are equivalent. They have the same Lie algebra. Now, for mu squared positive, and here, unfortunately, my artistic abilities are not very good. Do the best I can. Here's the phi 1, phi 2, v axis. And this potential has the minimum at the origin, and then it just goes up, and well, you can imagine, I haven't drawn it very well, but the, if you just, it's this minimum at the origin, and in the, it's rotationally invariant around the axis. So the minimum will clearly occur at nu 1 equals nu 2 equals 0, where nu I is just 0 phi I, 0. And it's Wigner-Weil realization. We have as consequences, so it's Wigner-Weil, and the consequences are degenerate states, phi 1 and phi 2, or equivalently in the other basis, phi and phi dagger are degenerate. The there's a conserved charge, which is more obvious when you go to the complex basis, and you have relations between couplings. There's a definite relation between the phi 1 to the 4 and the phi 2 to the 4 and the phi 1 squared, phi 2 squared 4-point vertices. Those are characteristics of Wigner-Weil. You can add explicit breaking. I could add a, write L equals L naught, call this L goes to, that was my original one, but let me say I could add to it another term, epsilon over 2 phi 2 squared. And epsilon over 2 phi 2 squared would have the effect that m1 squared is mu squared, and m2 squared is mu squared plus epsilon. So this explicit breaking would split the degeneracy a little bit. And it would tilt, if epsilon is positive, it means that you would distort the shape of this so it wasn't completely rotationally invariant and et cetera. Okay, that's straightforward. But now let's try the other case, mu squared negative. For mu squared less than 0, but lambda positive, the potential has this wine bottle shape, which is difficult for me to draw, but it's sort of best I can do is something like this, and you know, it really goes around this way, and there's a degenerate line of minima at the bottom. Like the bottom of the wine barrel, of the wine bottle. Just about everybody calls this the Mexican hat potential, but Higgs likes to call it the wine bottle, so I'm following his lead. Okay, in this case, the minimum, if you just take a minimize that potential, you find that the minimum is along somewhere along this line of minima. And this line of minima occurs in a, you know, in the circle in the new one, well, in the new one, new two plane, phi one, phi two. The origin is the top of the wine bottle. It's unstable, and the bottom, the minimum, is along some circle, and the circle has a radius r, which is equal to root minus mu squared over lambda. So you have nu 1 squared plus nu 2 squared, which I'll call nu squared, is equal to minus mu squared over lambda, which is positive. And so there's a whole line of degenerate minima. And the ground state can be, you can quantize around any point here. It's a purely a matter of convention which point you choose to quantize around. Any other point is equivalent by rotation, or it's like just choosing the z-axis along the direction that's convenient for you. So let's, without loss of generality, one can quantize around this point. In other words, I'll quantize around the point in which phi 1 has the vacuum expectation value. So I will write that phi 1 is equal to nu plus phi 1 prime. Phi 2 is equal to phi 2 prime. And then I rewrite the Lagrangian in terms of these variables. And I get that the kinetic energy terms I won't write again. They're of the same form. But the V phi 1 prime phi 2 prime becomes minus mu to the 4 over 4 lambda. That has the same implications as before. Minus mu squared phi 1 prime squared plus lambda nu phi 1 prime phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared plus lambda over 4 squared. So again, I have a quartic interaction, this same form as before. I have an induced cubic that you can think of as one of the four fields going into the vacuum. I have a term M1 squared equals minus 2 mu squared greater than 0. That's the mass of the physical phi 1 prime field. It corresponds to just oscillations in the phi 1 direction around the minimum. So, in other words, that mass term, masses are just the oscillations around the minimum of the potential. It corresponds to the oscillations in this direction. This is the particle that's called in the Higgs particle when one couples this to gauge theory. We haven't coupled it to a gauge theory, but this would be the Higgs particle. Notice that there is no mass term for phi 2 prime. So M2 squared, the mass of phi 2 squared, is 0. So this is called a Goldstone boson. The statement is that there, when quantizing around a minimum, there is a massless spin zero particle called the Goldstone or Nambu-Goldstone boson. When you quantize around this minimum, what you do is you just, at the minimum, just consider the mass matrix is the matrix of second derivatives of the potential. The two mass squared eigenvalues are just the eigenvalues of that mass matrix. One of them corresponds to oscillations this way, in which you have to go up and down the potential. But the other corresponds to oscillations along the line of minima. And the second derivative in that direction, evaluated right here, is 0. In other words, instead of oscillating, you can just roll along. That's why the Goldstone boson is massless. It's just a mode in which you roll around that minimum. This is completely general in a relativistic quantum field theory. It can be shown for any, no matter, you can write down a completely complicated theory with all kinds of complex and real scalars and fermions, and it can be proven non-perturbatively, even if in QCD something like this happens, but the Goldstone bosons are actually bound states, they're not elementary fields. It can be proven basically total generality. And there's only one loophole, and that is when there's a gauge theory, and that's the Higgs mechanism. Yes, sir?
I know that it's spinless.
How do I know they're what?
I know that
the Goldstone boson is spinless. It has to do with the nature of the transformation. And a simple way of putting it is that my original continuous symmetry had nothing to do with space-time variables, so it should be not surprising that there's no spin associated with it. Now, there's something analogous that happens in supersymmetry, in which the transformation does involve space-time in a rather complicated way. Supersymmetry is an extension of space-time symmetries. And there's something called a Goldsteinl, which is a spin 1/2 analog of the Goldstone boson. So it has to do with the type of symmetry you started with. If you were to spontaneously break a Lorentz symmetry, you would get Goldstone particles would spin. It's just that nature doesn't seem to do that, so we don't talk about it much. If the symmetry we were talking about were still, say, this U1, this global U1 symmetry, and and you just had a theory with fermions, you would still have a spin zero Goldstone boson. It would be a bound state. In fact, the original reason we call it the Nambu-Goldstone boson is the original example of this was in a model of fermions in which there was a non-renormalizable four Fermi interaction, and then the Goldstone boson did indeed emerge as a bound state spin zero particle. One can, in this case, add an explicit breaking. Just as I did up there for mu squared positive. So if I were to take a minus epsilon phi 2 squared over 2 with epsilon positive, that would clearly tilt the potential a little bit so that this would be the unique minimum, and you would have to have a quadratic term, non-zero quadratic positive term as you went in this direction. So now you would have a unique vacuum, or unique up to twofold, and there would be a small mass induced by the Goldstone to the Goldstone boson, just because you know it's no longer completely flat. In that case, m2 squared would be epsilon, and if epsilon is small compared to the magnitude of mu squared, then one can view that as just a small perturbation, and in this case, the particle is called a pseudo Goldstone boson. So it's not quite massless, but it only acquires a small mass because of this small explicit breaking. And this is important because in the strong interactions, I alluded yesterday to the fact that, or the day before, yesterday that there was an approximate chiral symmetry extension of isospin, and that chiral symmetry actually is spontaneously broken by strong interaction effects, but the pion emerges as a pseudo Goldstone boson. It's not an exact chiral symmetry, but the pions, it's really the mass squared of the boson that's associated with the perturbation, and the mass squared of the pion is smaller by about a factor of 100 or so than any other hadronic mass squared, and so indeed that small the pion is incredibly light, and that's the explanation. In the problem set, there will be a generalization of this model in which one, there is also a fermion introduced. And the U1 becomes a chiral symmetry. The fermion has a left and right chiral components, and there's a coupling between them, and the spin zero particle, the complex scalar that is still U1 invariant, and the question then is to analyze the spectrum in each case. And I will simply say without writing equations that whenever you have, remember I said that when with a chiral fermion, you can't generally have a mass term because a chiral symmetry is one in which the left and right have different phases under which they transform. For example, you might have psi left goes to e to the I beta, psi left and psi right not transform at all. That would be a chiral symmetry. So such symmetries don't allow elementary mass terms for the fermion, but they may allow a term, for example, psi bar left phi psi right, because now the psi left and the phi phases compensate, even though this one does nothing. In such a theory, you would expect a mass term to be generated if the phi field acquires a vacuum expectation value just as it did in my example of inducing the cubic interactions. So a chiral symmetry, fermions don't have masses to begin with, but they can actually acquire a mass by spontaneous symmetry breaking, whereas the Goldstone bosons are necessarily massless. Furthermore, in the chiral symmetry, I didn't ask you to do it, but the residual, the phi prime, and the Goldstone, the phi prime, the two components will still have couplings. To the fermions. And this one couples like a scalar, like a psi bar psi. This one turns out to couple always like a pseudoscalar. So and that's actually very important when one goes more deeply into these things. But it's an aside. I'm not going to develop it in any detail. Okay, so the whole subject of consequences of the symmetries and their breaking is complicated, and I haven't even gotten yet into the gauge theory part, which is another layer of complication on everything. I've actually put on that web page that I gave you the address of a table that sort of summarizes in all these cases all the things that happen, whether there's exact or explicit breaking, Figner-Weil versus Goldstone, chiral versus non-chiral, and it's probably worth poring over that because I know there's a lot of different cases and it's hard to keep them all together. Okay, so what I'm going to do on Monday is fairly quickly just write down Feynman rules for non-abelian gauge theory. Non-abelian gauge theory is really almost a trivial generalization of the things we've already done. We've done gauge U1s and we've done non-abelian global symmetries, and writing down the Lagrangian for non-abelian is pretty straightforward. And after then I will start actually applying all of that to quantum chromodynamics. And then eventually to the standard electroweak model. So have a good weekend. I will see you on Monday.